logged in. My sniffer grabbed his login credentials. I was stoked. Waiting anxiously until 6 o'clock a.m. when I figured he was likely to be fast asleep, I connected to his server and got in once again. Incredible. The file I had attempted to transfer the day before was still there. 30 minutes later, I had copied the file to one of my hacked accounts at Netcom. From the email and file exchanges between them, it appeared that Lator was the project lead, while Shimamura was working on it at his leisure. It was obvious that Tsutomu would also have the Aki code in his machine, and maybe even more information than I'd been able to grab from Lator. I was determined to find out. At some point, I needed to get back into Shimamura's computers. I guess I sometimes don't do a very good job of hiding my feelings. After I'd been working on the help desk at the Virginia Mason Medical Center for 3 months, my boss said to me one day, "We know you're bored here." "Yeah, you're right," I said. "I'll go find something else." Even though this left me jobless and with no income, I was glad not to face the boredom each day. Life, as they say, is too short. So it was back to Kinko's to make up some new phony resumes. I had brought along my handheld Radio Shack Pro 43 scanner, which I had loaded with the radio frequencies used by the FBI, DEA, Bureau of Prisons, and U.S. Marshals Service, as well as the Secret Service, because, as I've said before, the feds sometimes borrow other agencies' frequencies if they suspect their target might be listening. The scanner's squelch was set to pick up only nearby conversations. The new resumes were taking shape when I heard my radio crackle with voices. I opened the squelch a bit and waited. Moments later, radio traffic began on one of the Secret Service frequencies. "Any activity?" "Nothing here." "Very interesting." Some federal agency was apparently conducting a surveillance operation. I increased the volume and propped the scanner on top of the computer to get better reception. Soon the scanner began buzzing with voices. It sounded like the build-up to the climax of a television cop show. Obviously, a raid was being set up. "No activity here," one voice said. "We're in the alley covering the back," another answered. A girl working at the next PC asked what I was listening to. I smiled and said it was the Secret Service, then laughed as I added, "Sounds like somebody's going to have a bad night." She laughed, too. We both listened intently to see what would happen next. "Could he be at the computer store?" came blurting out from the radio. Now, that was weird. Computer store. Did their target work in a computer store, or could it be a customer? No response. I started to get a bit anxious and worried. Could it be me they were waiting for? I stopped working on the computer and paid closer attention to the radio. But then I heard, "What kind of car does our guy drive?" So it couldn't be me they were after. I was using public transportation. But still, I was wondering about the computer store thing. 20 minutes, and then, "We're going in now," and then radio silence. I continued working hard, drafting about 15 resumes for as many different businesses in the Seattle area, as usual tailoring them to meet 90% of the advertised requirements, my best shot at landing an interview. Still, nothing on the radio. The girl next to me got up, smiled, and wished me a good night. We both looked at the scanner and laughed, wondering what had happened to the guy they were waiting for. A little after midnight, I finished writing up all my resumes and cover letters. I waited in a long line of mostly students to have the resumes printed on ivory linen stock. Then, when it was finally my turn, I was told that my print job wouldn't be completed until morning. Damn, I wanted to get them out in the mail straight away. The clerk told me to try another Kinko's a few blocks away. I walked over to the other store but got the same story there. "We won't have your print job ready until the morning." "Fine." I said I'd pick it up in the morning, though I knew I'd likely be online all night, would sleep through the morning, and not get back to Kinko's until sometime in the afternoon. It didn't turn out like that. On the way home, I stopped at the 24-hour Safeway near my apartment and bought some groceries plus a turkey sandwich and some potato chips for a late-night dinner. It was a little after 1 o'clock a.m. when I got back to my apartment building. The Secret Service operation I'd heard over my scanner had left me feeling a bit jittery. Like a character in a spy novel, I took the precaution of walking down the opposite side of the street so I could look for any suspicious cars, and to make sure my apartment lights were still on. But they weren't. The apartment was dark. Not good. I always left some lights on. Had I forgotten this time, or was it something else? There was a red truck parked on the street, and I could see two figures in the front seat, a man and a woman kissing. That conjured up a funny notion. Could it be two federal agents making out as a cover? Not likely, but the thought relieved my tension a little. I walked straight up to the truck and asked the passenger, "Hey, sorry to interrupt, but I was supposed to meet my buddy here. Did you see anyone hanging out around here waiting?" "No, but people were carrying boxes out of that apartment," as she pointed to the windows of my apartment. "What the fuck?" I thanked her and said that wasn't where my friend lived. I bolted up the stairs to the apartment of the building manager, David, and rang his doorbell, even though I knew I'd be waking him up. A drowsy voice shouted out, "Who is it?" When I didn't answer, he opened the door a crack. "Oh, hi, Brian," he said in a sleepy, irritated voice. I tried my best to hide my anxiety. "Did you let anyone into my apartment?" His answer was a stunner, something I could never have expected. "No, but the cops and the Secret Service busted down your door. The Seattle police left a search warrant and a business card saying you should call them right away." Starting to wake up enough to be truly annoyed now, he added, "And you're going to pay for the door, right?"
"Yeah, sure."
I told him I was going to call them right away. Sweating, with a sour taste of panic in my mouth and a sinking feeling in my stomach, I bolted back down the stairs and through the alley looking for some sign of trouble, an unmarked car, movement on the roof, anything. Nothing. Nobody. One small blessing. If it was the Seattle police, not the FBI, then they were looking for the Brian Merrill who had been making unauthorized cell phone calls, not for fugitive hacker Kevin Mitnick. Drews had said the Seattle police and Secret Service searched my place and then just left. Surely they wouldn't be lame enough to toss my place without staying around to make the arrest. I walked away fast, knowing I didn't dare run. Sure, the manager must already be on the phone calling the cops or feds to report that I had shown up and then split. Still carrying the briefcase I had thankfully left the house with hours earlier. It contained all my paperwork for new identities. I was expecting to see a police or unmarked car any second. I dropped my bag of groceries into someone's trash. My heart was starting to beat faster and faster. I walked as fast as I could without breaking into a jog, staying away from major streets until I was a couple blocks away from my apartment. I kept thinking about all the stuff in my briefcase, including those blank but certified birth certificates from South Dakota. But I couldn't ditch those documents. I would need them more than ever now. My new permanent identity had just flown out the window, forever useless. So I hung onto the briefcase. I was sure that a team of feds was lurking nearby waiting for me, in one of the parked cars, behind some trees, in the doorway of an apartment building down the block. My mouth started to get very dry, as if I hadn't drunk any water in a few days. I was so nervous I was beginning to feel dizzy. Sweat was dripping down my face. I reached a bar, huffing and puffing, way out of place among the noisy, laughing people partying, drinking it up, having a good time. I hid in a stall in the men's room. I wanted to call my mom, but didn't dare use the cell phone, so I just sat there thinking out my options. Call a cab and get the hell out of the area as soon as possible? The Secret Service could be driving around looking for me. I just wanted to disappear into the crowd. When I had rested long enough to get my breath back, I took to the sidewalk again, looking for a taxi to take me out of the area. A bus rolled past. A bus, a ticket out of the neighborhood. I ran my ass off to catch it at the stop in the next block. Where it was going didn't matter, just away from here. I stayed on for an hour, to the end of the line, then got off and walked in the cool air to clear my head. At a 7-Eleven, I called my mom's pager from the payphone, sending her a code 3, emergency. I waited, giving her time to get up, get dressed, drive to a casino, and page me back to let me know where she was. After about 40 minutes, my pager buzzed, showing me the phone number for Caesar's Palace. I called the hotel and had her paged, waiting impatiently until she picked up. As you might imagine, it wasn't easy to tell her about my close call and that I didn't dare go back to my apartment. I was depressed, but it could have been worse, I pointed out. I could be sitting in some jail cell. When we hung up, I picked a motel from the Yellow Pages with an address in downtown Seattle near Pike Place Market, where the first Starbucks opened. I called a cab and had the driver stop at an ATM where I withdrew the maximum amount, $500. The name I put on the registration form at the motel was Eric Weiss, the old identity that I still had documents for in my briefcase. The next morning, I would be out of there, gone from Seattle without a trace. I hoped. I went to bed feeling a huge sense of loss. The only possessions I still had were the clothes on my back, a couple of things at the dry cleaners, and the briefcase full of identity documents. Everything else was still in that apartment. I was an early riser the next morning. The raid had been at night. I was hoping that the feds had knocked off after filing the paperwork and logging all the evidence, that they hadn't bothered to start looking through my computer or papers where they would have found a receipt from the dry cleaners and a checkbook showing where I kept my stash of cash. First stop, because it opened early, was the dry cleaners to pick up the only clothes I would have besides the jeans, black leather jacket, and Hard Rock t-shirt I was wearing. The bank opened at 9 o'clock a.m., and guess who was the first customer through the door? I closed out my checking account. It had only about $4,000 in it, but I was going to need every penny of that for my next disappearing act. The local cops had grabbed my laptop, floppy disks, my second radio scanner, computer peripherals, and unencrypted backup tapes. It could be only a matter of days before they figured out that Brian Merrill, the cell phone cloner, was really Kevin Mitnick, the Fed's most wanted hacker. Or did they already know? For any clever social engineer, the answer to a question like that is never hard to come by. Placing a call to the office of the Seattle District Attorney, I asked which DA handled electronic fraud cases. Ivan Orton, I was told. Calling Orton's secretary, I told her, "This is Special Agent Robert Terrence, Secret Service. Do you have a copy of the search warrant and affidavit on the cell phone case from last night?" "No, you'll have to call records," and she recited the number. The lady in records asked me for the address where the search had taken place. When I told her, she said, "Oh, yes, I have it right here." "Great, I'm in the field. Can you please fax me a copy?" "I'm sorry," she said. "We don't have a fax machine in records." That didn't faze me. "No problem," I said. "I'll call you back." No fax machine in the records office? Incredible. We're talking 1994 here. Everybody had a fax. But no. Calls to other offices in the building revealed that the city of Seattle apparently didn't have much of a budget for fax machines. I finally discovered that the law library had one. By the time I'd finished making arrangements, the lady from the law library was on her way up to the records office to fetch a copy of the affidavit so she could get the fax sent to the Secret Service agent who needed it. I had it faxed to a Kinko's in Bellevue, waited until I thought it would have been received, used my standard routine for laundering a fax, and picked it up minutes later from the second Kinko's location. All done in such a short interval that there was no chance the cops or Secret Service could have shown up in time. I sat down in a coffee shop and pored over the affidavit, absorbing every word. I learned that two cellular phone fraud investigators had been tailing me for several weeks. I flashed back to a Jeep that had been parked across the street one day with a man sitting in it. Son of a bitch, my gut had been right. He was one of the investigators. The statements in the search warrant showed that these guys had been eavesdropping on my calls for weeks. I thought of the calls I made to my mom several times a week. She would sometimes speak my name when she picked up my call in the casino. Yet evidently they had missed that. They must have known, or at least sensed, I wasn't just some kid using a cloned cell phone. Yet they were clueless about my real identity. If they had suspected I was the sought-after Kevin Mitnick, they would have staked out my apartment and waited all night for me to come home. I was worried that they had recorded my calls or perhaps even taken photographs of me. Knowing that they had heard my voice, I called Lewis so he could chew over the situation with me and help assess the damage. I came up with a plan. Lewis would call one of the private investigators and see what information he could find out. I really needed to know if they had any tapes or photos. I was on the line listening in, my cell phone muted. Lewis called a private investigator named Kevin Pazaski and pretended to be prosecutor Ivan Orton. Pazaski said, "We have a meeting tomorrow at your office." Lewis seized the opportunity and replied, "Yes, our meeting is still on, but I have a few urgent questions." He asked if he had any tape recordings. Pazaski said no. They had monitored conversations and made notes, but no tapes. Phew, that was a relief. Next, Lewis asked if they had any photos of the suspect. Again, the answer was no. Thank God. Lewis then added the icing to the cake. "Okay, Kevin, I'll have more questions prepared for our meeting tomorrow. See you then." Despite how stressed out I was, Lewis and I started laughing after he hung up, just imagining those guys' reaction at the big meeting the next day when they realized they had been conned. But by then it would be too late for them to do anything about it. I had the information I wanted. It was worth the effort. From the documents, I confirmed that the raid had been intended to nab somebody who had been making lots of unauthorized cell phone calls. Nothing about Kevin Mitnick. That was why the agents had just left a card saying I should pay the Seattle police a call. The cops didn't think it was worth hanging around just to catch some college student who'd figured out how to make free cell phone calls. Under different circumstances, I might have felt relieved. I left Seattle on a Greyhound bus headed for Tacoma, where I would board a train for Portland and then fly the last leg of the trip to Los Angeles. En route, I called Ron Austin and told him I had been raided. Turned out my talking to Ron wasn't such a great idea. Like Peterson, he had become a snitch in the hope of getting a reduced sentence. He'd been recording our conversations and turning the tapes over to the FBI, playing both sides all along. Being a friend to me by giving me the California DMV access, while at the same time cooperating with the feds. He was out on bail, gathering information on Lewis and me for FBI Special Agent McGuire and company. I'll admit he did a clever job of gaining my trust by giving me access to the DMV database. Now he called his bureau handler to let him know that the guy the Secret Service had just raided for cell phone cloning was really Kevin Mitnick. I hadn't told him what city I was in, but I'm sure it didn't take the Secret Service very long to figure it out. In a conversation we had while I was writing this audiobook, Austin also revealed an interesting tidbit. The feds cloned his pager and waited for my calls to get the payphone number and the time I would be calling so they could attempt to trace my next call. They didn't realize that I had full access to the telco switches that controlled the numbers I was calling, and that I always checked for any traps and watched for any switch messages indicating that a trace was being done in real time. I had to be cautious, especially with a skilled hacker like Austin. My countermeasures were obviously effective. The feds had never showed up at my door. Arriving in L.A., I picked a hotel conveniently near Union Station. Getting up in the middle of the night, I turned on the light to find dozens of cockroaches skittering around the floor. Ew! I had to put on my shoes just to walk the few steps to the bathroom, first cautiously shaking out each shoe to be sure it wasn't occupied by any of the critters. The chills down my spine were overwhelming. I couldn't get out of there fast enough. I was gone 15 minutes later, moving to a place called the Metro Plaza Hotel, which I chose because it had a special meaning for me. When I was held in solitary confinement at L.A.'s Federal Metropolitan Detention Center, my room had looked out over this hotel. How often I had wished I could be there instead of in my 10-by-8-foot room with its stone-like mattress. I hadn't seen my dad in a long time. He listened to the story of my near arrest and the cops, not even knowing, they had almost nabbed a guy the Bureau had been hunting for 2 years. I got an absence of response from him, as if he didn't know how to help me. It was as if I were describing a scene from a movie or something pulled from my creative imagination. I called Bonnie, said I was in L.A. and wanted to get together. Why call her? There weren't many people I could talk to about my predicament. My hacking buddies, one after another, had turned disloyal. There wasn't anybody else in Los Angeles I could trust. She had her own reason for being willing to see me. DePayne knew that my computer, tapes, and disks had been seized in Seattle, and he wanted to know how much of our correspondence the cops might have found, and how much of it would incriminate him. Bonnie was probably serving the interests of her lover, hoping to get some assurances from me that the Seattle police and the Secret Service weren't going to turn up any information in my electronic files that could land him in trouble. We met, and I told her I had lost everything and needed to start over. Though the files on my computer were encrypted, I had backed up most of them onto cartridge tapes, unencrypted, that I'd been about to stash in my bank safety deposit box, but I'd never made it to the bank with the tapes, which meant that either the feds or the local Seattle cops had all that information, unencrypted. She could see I was freaking out. She tried to calm me down and offer advice, but we both knew that my only options were to turn myself in and suffer months, if not years, of solitary confinement, or to keep playing the game of catch me if you can. I had all along opted for the latter, and the stakes were even higher now, because the charge would no longer be a mere violation of my supervised release. With the evidence from my seized computer in Seattle, the feds now had plenty of hard evidence of my hacking. I felt Bonnie's intuition. She was sure it would be just a matter of time before I got caught, and she was worried for me. But I just had to give it my best shot and deal with the consequences later. It was nice to see her again for the first time since I'd gone on the run, but given that my ex was living with my best hacking partner, a distance between us was only natural. By the time I reached Vegas a week later, my mom and Graham had pretty much calmed down from their panic at my near arrest. When I saw them, I was washed in the full flood of their love and concern. Desperately in need of a new identity and knowing it would be dangerous to use any of the names from the South Dakota list since all that information was also on the unencrypted backup tapes that the cops had grabbed in the Seattle raid, I targeted the largest college in Oregon's largest city, Portland State University. After compromising the server for the admissions office, I called the database administrator. "I'm new in the admissions office," I told him, "and I need to look at," and then I described the parameters of what I was looking for. People who had received undergraduate degrees between 1985 and 1992. He spent a good 45 minutes on the phone with me, explaining how the records were organized and the commands I needed to extract all the student data for graduates in the years of interest. He was so helpful that he gave me even more than I was asking for. When we were done, I had access to 13,595 student records, each one complete with a student's full name, date of birth, degree, year of degree, social security number, and home address. For the time being, I needed only one of the thousands. I would become Michael David Stanfill. The heat was on. The feds had probably figured out by now that I'd slipped through their fingers again. This time my Vegas trip would be short, just long enough to let me set up a new identity, 2 to 3 weeks. Then I needed to scat quickly in case the feds got desperate enough to start following my mother, her boyfriend, or my grandmother. I had to make headway on building my new identity as Michael Stanfill. For the driver's license, after the familiar steps of getting a certified copy of the birth certificate and making a phony W-2, I applied for a learner's permit, offering the lady at the DMV my familiar explanation that I needed a few lessons because I had been living in London where we drove on the other side of the road. It had only been a couple of years since I had gotten my Eric Weiss driver's license at the DMV in Las Vegas, so I felt a bit uneasy about going back, especially since I knew the feds might now be on the alert for my trying to get a new identity. The closest DMV office outside of Las Vegas was in the desert town of Pahrump, which is famous for two things. The popular radio personality Art Bell lives there, and it's also the home of the Chicken Ranch, the infamous legal brothel. Under Nevada law, prostitution is permitted in that part of the state. I combed the yellow pages looking for a driving school in Pahrump. Finding none, I started calling places in Vegas, though, of course, carefully avoiding the one I had used a couple years back as Eric Weiss, asking if I could use one of their cars for my drive test in Pahrump. After being told several times, "Sorry, we don't send our people out to Pahrump," I finally found a school that would provide a car, give a one-hour lesson to a guy who was just back from London and in need of a refresher for driving on the right side of the road, and wait while I took the test, all for $200. Fine. $200 was a cheap price for a new identity. Graham drove me the hour to Pahrump. I asked her to wait for me down the road at a restaurant because it would be too risky for both of us if something went wrong the way it had at Kinko's on that Christmas Eve of recent memory. We arrived 20 minutes early, and I sat inside the tiny DMV office on a cheap plastic chair, anxiously waiting for the school's car to drive up. In less than 2 hours, I should be able to walk out with my brand new identity in the name of Michael David Stanfill. As I looked up, the driving instructor walked in the door. Son of a bitch. It was the same guy I'd had for my Eric Weiss identity 2 years earlier. He must have changed driving schools. Just my luck. It's remarkable how the subconscious mind can swing into action and devise a plan in an instant. I opened my mouth, and what came out was, "Hey, I know you. Where do you shop for groceries?" "Smith's on Maryland Parkway," he answered as he struggled to remember where he recognized me from. "Yeah, right," I said. "That's where I've seen you. I shop there all the time." "Oh, I thought I'd seen you before," he said, sounding satisfied. Now I had to change my story, because I had used London the last time as well. Instead, I told him I had been serving in the Peace Corps in Uganda and hadn't been behind the wheel of a car in 5 years. Worked like a charm. He was pleased with how quickly I recovered my driving ability. I passed the test without a hitch and walked away with my Michael Stanfill driver's license. Part 4. An End and a Beginning. 33. Hacking the Samurai. With my new identity credentials in order, it was time to get clear of Las Vegas before my luck ran out. The 1994 Christmas New Year's holiday time was just ahead, and I couldn't resist the idea of a return visit to Denver, a city I had grown so fond of. Packing up, I took along an old ski jacket of mine, thinking I might be able to get in a little more time on the slopes over the holidays. But once I arrived in Denver and settled into an attractive, medium-priced hotel, two people I had never met, that arrogant Japanese-American security expert whose server I had hacked into a year earlier, and the other, an extraordinarily skilled computer hacker in Israel, would become actors in a drama that would change the entire rest of my life. I had come across an Israeli who went by his initials, JSZ. We met over Internet Relay Chat, an online service for finding and chatting with strangers who shared similar interests. In our case, the interest was hacking. Eventually, he told me that he had hacked most, if not all, of the major software manufacturers that developed operating systems. Sun, Silicon Graphics, IBM, SCO, and so on. He had copied source code from their internal development systems and planted back doors to get back in anytime he wanted. That was quite a feat. Very impressive. We started sharing our hacking conquests with each other and information on new exploits, backdooring systems, cell phone cloning, acquiring source code, and compromising the systems of vulnerability researchers. During one call, he asked if I had read the Morris paper on IP spoofing, which revealed a major vulnerability in the core protocol of the Internet. Robert T. Morris, a computer prodigy, had found a clever security flaw that could be exploited using a technique called IP spoofing to bypass authentication that relied on the remote user's IP address. 10 years after Morris published his paper, a group of hackers, including JSZ in Israel, had created a tool for it. Since it was only theoretical up to that time, nobody had thought to protect against it. For the technically minded, the IP spoofing attack in this case relied on an older technology known as the R services, which required configuring each computer system so that it would accept trusted connections, meaning that a user could log into an account, depending on the configuration, without needing to provide the password. This made it possible for a system admin to configure a server to trust other computers for the purpose of authentication. One example is where a system admin manages multiple machines, so when he or she is logged in as root, no password would be required to log into other systems that trust the server. In the IP spoofing attack, the attacker's first step is to look for other systems that are likely to be trusted by the root account on the target server. meaning a user logged into root on a trusted system can log into the root account on the target server without supplying a password. It wasn't too difficult in this case. By using the finger command, the attacker was able to identify that our victim was connected to the target system from another computer located in the same local area network. It was very likely that these two systems trusted each other for root access. The next step was to establish a connection to the target system by forging the trusted computer's IP address. This is where it got a bit tricky. When two systems are establishing an initial connection over TCP, a series of packets are sent back and forth to create a session between them. This is called a three-way handshake. During the handshake, the target system transmits a packet back to the machine trying to establish the connection. Because the targeted server believes it's responding to the real system's request to establish a connection, the handshake process fails because the attacker's system never receives the packet to complete the three-way handshake. Enter the TCP sequence number. The protocol uses sequence numbers to acknowledge the receipt of data. If the attacker could predict the sequence number of the packet being sent from the target system to the real server during the initial handshake, he could complete the process by sending an acknowledgement packet with the correct sequence number and establish a connection appearing to be from the trusted machine. This effectively established a session by guessing the TCP sequence number. Because the targeted system was fooled into thinking it had established a connection with a trusted machine, it allowed the hacker to exploit the trust relationship and bypass the usual password requirement, allowing full access to the machine. At this point, the attacker could write over the current rhosts file on the target machine, allowing anyone access to the root account without a password. In summary, the attack relied on the attacker being able to predict the TCP sequence number of the packet sent by the target computer at the time of the initial contact. If an attacker could successfully predict the TCP sequence number that the target would use during the handshaking process, the attacker could impersonate a trusted computer and bypass any security mechanisms that rely on the user's IP address. I told JSZ I had read the article, but it's theoretical, hasn't been done yet. Well, my friend, methinks it has. We've already developed the tool and it works amazingly well, he said, referring to a piece of software that he and some associates spread throughout Europe had been working on. No way! You're kidding me! I'm not. I asked him if I could have a copy. Maybe later, he said, but I'll run it for you anytime you want. Just give me a target. I shared with JSZ the details of my hack into Mark Lator's server and his interesting connection with Tsutomu Shimomura, using his nickname. I explained how I'd hacked into UCSD and sniffed the network until someone named Ariel connected to Shimomura's server, after which I was finally able to get in. Shimmy somehow realized that one of the people who had access to his computer had been hacked, and he booted me off after several days, I said. I had seen some of the security bugs Shimmy had reported to Sun and Deck and had been impressed with his bug-finding skills. In time, I would learn that he had shoulder-length, straight black hair, a preference for showing up at work wearing sandals and raggedy-ass jeans, and a passion for cross-country skiing. He sounded every bit like the kind of Californian conjured up by the term dude, as in, hey dude, how's it hangin'? I told JSZ that Shimmy might have the Aki source code or the details of his and Lator's reverse engineering efforts, not to mention any new security bugs he might have discovered. On Christmas Day, 1994, walking out of a movie at the Tivoli Center in downtown Denver, I powered up my cloned cell phone and called JSZ to jokingly wish him a Jewish Merry Christmas. Glad you called, he said. In a cool, collected voice, he told me, I have a Christmas present for you. My friend, I got into Ariel tonight. And he gave me the port number where he'd set up the back door. Once you connect, there is no prompt. You just type dot shimmy, and you get a root shell. No fucking way! To me, it was a great Christmas present. I had been wanting to get back into Shimmy's computer to find out more about what he and Mark Lator were up to with the Aki cell phone project, and I wanted to know if either of them had access to the source code. Either way, I was going to grab whatever information I could find on his server related to the Aki 900 and 1150 cell phones. It was known in the hacker community that Shimmy had a very arrogant demeanor. He thought he was smarter than everyone else around him. We decided to bring his ego down a few notches toward reality, just because we could. The drive back to the hotel in my rental car felt like just about the longest 20 minutes of my life, but I didn't dare drive faster than the flow of traffic. If I got pulled over and the cop came up with something suspicious about my driver's license, it might be a hell of a lot longer than 20 minutes before I could get online again. Patience. Patience. As soon as I walked into my hotel room, I powered up my laptop and dialed up to Colorado SuperNet, masking the call as usual by using my cell phone cloned to some random Denverite. I fired up a network talk program that would make me a direct connection to JSZ's computer in Israel so we could communicate in one window as we hacked Shimmy in another. I connected to Shimmy's computer using the back door that JSZ had set up. Bingo. I was in with root privileges. Incredible. What a high. That must be what a kid feels on reaching the top level of a video game that he's struggled with for months, or like reaching the summit of Mount Everest. Thrilled, I congratulated JSZ on a job well done. For openers, JSZ and I probed Shimmy's system looking for the most valuable information, anything to do with security bugs, his email, and any files that had Aki in their name. He had tons of files. As I was archiving and compressing everything that matched my criteria, JSZ was also probing around for anything that would be useful. Both of us were very concerned that Shimmy might decide to log in to check his email for Christmas greetings and find out he was being hacked. We wanted to get his stuff before he figured it out. I was worried he might pull the network connection, just as Lator had done several months earlier. We were working fast to get the information off Shimmy's machine. My endorphins were on major overload. After searching, archiving, and compressing, I needed a place to store the code for safekeeping. No problem. I already had root access to every server at the Whole Earth Electronic Link, commonly known as The Well. Started by Stuart Brand and a partner, The Well had as its users a who's who of the internet, but the celebrity status of the site didn't matter to me at all. My only concern was whether there was enough disk space and whether I could hide the files well enough that the system admins wouldn't notice them. In fact, I had been spending lots of time on the site. A few days after John Markoff's front page New York Times story appeared, I discovered he had an account on The Well. An easy target. I had been reading his emails ever since, searching for anything related to me. After I finished moving the targeted stuff, we decided to just grab everything in Shimmy's home directory. JSZ archived and compressed his entire home directory into a single file that amounted to more than 140 megabytes. We held our breath until the file was successfully transferred, then gave each other electronic high fives over chat. JSZ moved a copy of the file to a system in Europe in case some Well system admin happened to find the huge file and delete it. I also copied the file to a couple of other locations. JSZ kept telling me that finding the simple back door he had set up for my access would be easy for Shimmy. I agreed. It was too easy to find. I suggested that we consider placing a more sophisticated backdoor in the operating system itself, where it would be much harder to detect. "He'll find it," JSZ countered. "Yeah, we could always get back in later the same way," I said. I logged off the system and JSZ cleaned up, removing the simple backdoor and deleting all logs of our activity. It was a very exciting moment. We had gotten into the security expert's server, in my case, for the second time in little over a year. JSZ and I decided we would each examine Shimmy's files independently and then report back to the other on what we found. But no matter how careful we were to erase our tracks, I figured it was almost certain that Shimmy would stumble onto some telltale sign we had overlooked. Sifting through Shimmy's old emails, I came across messages back and forth between him and my nemesis, New York Times technology scribe John Markoff. The two of them had been exchanging emails going back to early 1991 about me, trading bits of information on what I was up to, as in an exchange in early 92 that showed Shimmy had gone to the trouble of researching online for my ham radio license, call sign N6NHG. He also emailed Markoff asking whether the FCC had a rule against issuing ham radio licenses to a person convicted of a felony. Why the two of them had such an interest in me was still a mystery. I had never met Shimmy, never interacted with him in any way except for the recent hacks into his system. So why would the two of them be so interested in what I was doing? I was right about one thing. Shimmy very quickly learned of our break-in. Because JSZ and I were both so focused on getting a copy of his files, we didn't notice that he was running TCP Dump, a network monitoring tool to capture all network traffic. We also didn't notice that a program called Cron was periodically emailing his system logs to Andrew Gross, Shimmy's assistant. Gross realized the logs were getting smaller and tipped off Shimmy that something suspicious was going on. As soon as Shimmy looked through the logs, he realized he had been hacked. It didn't matter much. We had his files, and we could spend the days and weeks ahead carefully examining them. Why would Shimmy be running a network monitoring tool to capture everything going through his server? Paranoia? Or was it a bait machine? Because he was so high profile in the computer security world, he knew it was just a matter of time before someone would nail his butt with a clever new attack. I thought maybe it was a bait machine, left accessible so he could monitor all the incoming attacks and profile the methods being used. But in that case, why would he leave all his files on this machine? And even a network wiretapping tool called BPF, for Berkeley Packet Filter, that he had created for the United States Air Force, which could insert itself directly into an operating system without requiring a reboot. Maybe he just underestimated his opponents and assumed no one would ever get in. It's still a mystery. Many people credit me with being the guy who developed the program that was used to hack into Shimmy's servers using the IP spoofing attack. I'd be proud if I really had been the one who managed that rather astounding feat, and I'd be glad to take credit for it. But the credit's not mine. Instead, that honor belongs to the wickedly clever JSZ, the guy who actually participated in developing the tool and used it for our Christmas Day break-in to Shimmy's server. I had enjoyed my time back in Denver for the holidays, especially because we were able to get into Shimmy's system. But time was up. I needed to put that grand city behind me and push off for my next destination. I was still elated about the success of the Shimmy hack, but I would live to regret it. Those few hours would eventually lead to my undoing. I had unleashed a hacker vigilante who would stop at nothing to get even with me. 34. Hiding in the Bible Belt. Imagine yourself in a strange city where you have no close, trusted friends. You avoid the other people in your apartment building because your photo has been prominently displayed in supermarket tabloids and in weekly news magazines. You're being hunted by the FBI, the U.S. Marshals, and the Secret Service, so you're afraid of getting too friendly with anyone. And your biggest form of entertainment is the very thing you're being hunted for. Although I hadn't counted on needing to leave Seattle in a hurry, I had been giving some thought to where I would go next if I ever had to pull up stakes. I had considered Austin because it was known for its technology, and Manhattan because it was, well, Manhattan. But just as I had done when I chose Denver, I again relied on Money Magazine's annual assessment of the 10 best cities in America. That year, Raleigh, North Carolina, was listed as number one. The description sounded tempting. The people were supposed to be pleasant and laid back, the surrounding area rural, with mountains in the distance. Flying had always stressed me out, so once again I had decided to take the train, and it would be cool to see what the rest of the country looked like. After my Christmas stopover in Denver and the raid on Shimmy's servers, I boarded another Amtrak on New Year's Eve for the 3-day trip to Raleigh as Michael Stanfill. The sleeper car was more expensive than flying, but what an eye-opening experience it turned out to be, watching the American landscape roll past. The people I met on the train gave me a perfect opportunity to practice my cover story, providing details of my life and background as Stanfill, By the time I arrived in North Carolina, I had to have my identity down pat. The train pulled into the Raleigh station after dark. I had heard so much about the South, how its culture and people were different, how it moved at a slower pace. Maybe its reputation was a remnant of the South of a long time ago. I was curious to find out for myself. That evening, I walked around the northern section of Raleigh, getting a feeling for the city. I had imagined the South would have a warm and cozy climate. Instead, it felt as cold as Denver. The winter temperatures in Raleigh, I would discover, were about the same as those in the Mile High City. But as I walked around, getting a sense of the place, I spotted a restaurant familiar to me, one of the Boston Market chain. Not exactly Southern, but I went in for dinner anyway. My waitress was a cute 20-something girl with long dark hair, a heartwarming smile, and one of those luscious Southern drawls I hadn't known really existed anymore. She greeted me with a friendly, "Hi, how are you?" Reading her name tag, I said, "Hey, Cheryl, I'm doing great. I just arrived in town, my first time in North Carolina." After she took my order, I said, "I'm going to be looking for an apartment. Maybe you can tell me a good part of town to settle in." She smiled and said she'd be right back. When she served my food, she and a couple of the other waitresses sat down to talk with me while I ate. I couldn't imagine that happening in Los Angeles or Seattle or even in outgoing Denver. The ladies told me, "We just want to keep you company." I was blown away by my first taste of Southern hospitality, friendliness sweeter than anything I had ever encountered. The girls talked up life in Raleigh. They told me about the different areas of town, where to live, what to do. It was tobacco-growing country still, but had also gone high-tech with the technology companies of nearby Research Triangle Park. They were boosters for their city, and for some reason, I interpreted that as a good sign that this was where I needed to be. Only a week after my arrival, I found a lovely apartment in northwestern Raleigh, in an elaborate complex called The Lakes, a suitable name since its 80-plus acres included shorelines on two separate lakes. The place featured not just an Olympic-sized pool, tennis courts, and racquetball courts, but two volleyball courts. The management had trucked in loads of sand to create a beach-like setting. The lakes also featured parties every weekend for all the residents, described to me as lively, noisy affairs crowded with lots of smiling Southern beauties. My apartment was small, but who cared? I felt as if I were living a dream. I stopped by You Save Auto Rental, a one-man operation, the kind of place where the owner takes a hard look at the people who come in, as if he were thinking that they might not be planning on bringing his car back. He cast a doubtful expression at me, too, but I responded with friendly, unhurried chat, and he warmed up. "I've just been through a hideous divorce," I told him. "I came to Raleigh because it's a long way from Vegas, you know what I mean?" This was my attempt to explain why I would be paying in cash. As part of the act, I handed him my business card for the company I had supposedly worked for in Vegas, the same phony company I'd created to get the law firm job in Denver. By the time I was ready to climb into my temporary rattle trap, he let me drive away without even checking my references. I kept thinking about the last remaining step of the Motorola hack, getting hold of a compiler that would translate the source code into a form the cell phone chip could understand. Having the compiler would allow me to make changes to the source code and compile a new version of the firmware that would shrink my visibility. For example, letting me toggle on and off how my cell phone communicated with the mobile provider to disable tracking, and adding functions that would make it easy to change the ESN from the cell phone's keypad so I could easily clone my phone to any other subscriber's number. Once I was back in the saddle for this effort, a little research showed me that Motorola used a compiler from a company called Intermetrics, which quickly made it to the top of my list of hacking targets. I identified a computer called blackhole.inmet.com that was on Intermetrics' internal network, directly accessible from the Internet. When I realized that the company's systems were patched against all the latest security vulnerabilities, I quickly changed tactics. Conveniently, Black Hole turned out to be vulnerable to the same IP spoofing attack that JSZ and I had used against Shimmy. When I got into the system, I saw that two system administrators were logged in and apparently busy at work. rather than risk being discovered in case one of them checked the currently established network connections, I looked for alternate ways to access the company remotely that would not be easily detected. Maybe I could find a dial-up number and connect over my modem. In the files of one of the system administrators, Annie Oriel, I found a file with a promising name, modem. Yes, the file held the text of an email she had sent to other employees, informing them of the dial-up numbers. It read, in part, "We currently have two dial-in hunt groups. The 661-1940 group consists of 8 9600 BPS telebit modems, which connect directly into the Annex terminal server. The 661-4611 hunt group has 8 2400 BPS Zoom modems, which currently connect to the terminal server." Bingo. 661-1940 and 661-4611 were the dial-in numbers I was looking for. I changed the password on what appeared to be a few dormant accounts on the Annex terminal server and dialed in to avoid the risk of being detected on any of the internet-facing systems. System Administrator Oriel appeared to use the host black hole as her personal workstation. I figured she would eventually want root privileges to perform an administrative task and would use the Unix switch user command SU. So I set up a way of capturing the root password when she did. For the technical listener, using the source code I had obtained from Sun Microsystems, I added some additional code to the SU program and recompiled it so when she SU'd to root, it would secretly log her password to a file hidden on her workstation. It worked just as I had expected. The root password was OMGNA exclamation point. Oh my God, no dictionary words, and with the exclamation mark thrown in to make guessing it that much more difficult. The same root password worked on every other server I tried it on. Having that password was like having the keys to the kingdom, at least for Intermetrics' internal network. At this point, I logged into inmet.com, which was the company's domain used for receiving email from the outside world. I downloaded a copy of the master password file, which also contained the password hashes, so I could attempt to crack all the passwords offline. Now I was in position to search emails looking for people who had been in contact with Motorola. My first lead was an email to an Intermetrics engineer named Marty Stolz, who had received a message from someone at Motorola explaining a problem they were having with the compiler. I hacked into Stolz's workstation and examined his shell history, which showed a list of commands he had previously typed. He had run a particular program, a shell script called MakeProd, which he had used to build compiler products that the company developed. In this case, I wanted the 68HC11 compiler so I could compile the Motorola source code for the MicroTac Ultralight. The engineer who wrote the script had also included detailed comments in his source code that led me to the location where the software developers kept the production releases of the Motorola chip compiler for various operating system platforms. Along the way, I found that Intermetrics was producing this compiler in versions for several different OS platforms, including Apollo, Sun OS, VMS, and Unix. Yet when I examined the server where all these compiler versions were supposed to be, not one of them was there. I spent hours searching other file servers and developer workstations, but the compilers weren't there either. Not the source code, nor the binaries. Strange. I checked the aliases file, which listed where incoming emails for particular individuals and work groups were to be forwarded. By examining that file, I was able to identify which employees were associated with which departments and found the name of a company employee in Washington, David Burton. Time for a little social engineering. I called Marty Stolz, introduced myself with David's name, and said, "I have a major customer demo tomorrow morning, and I can't find the compiler for the 68HC11 on the server that stores product releases. I've got an old version, but I need the latest version." He asked me a few questions. What department was I in, my location, the name of my manager, and so on. Then he said, "Listen, I'm going to tell you something, but you have to keep it a secret." What could he be talking about? "I won't tell anybody." In a half whisper, he said, "The FBI called us and told us there's a guy who will probably be targeting us, a super hacker who broke into Motorola and stole their source code. They think this guy is going to want a compiler for the Motorola code, and he's going to target us next. So the feds had figured out I'd want the compiler, and they'd called Intermetrics to head me off? Hey, I had to give them some credit. That was good thinking. He broke into the CIA and got level 3 access, Marty was telling me. Nobody can stop this guy. He's always one step ahead of the FBI. Unbelievable. You're putting me on. Sounds like that kid in War Games. Listen, the FBI told us we better take those compilers offline or he'll get to them for sure. I blinked. After I got the Motorola code, it had taken me a few days even to come up with that idea. And the FBI had thought of it before I did? That really was unbelievable. Geez, I need to test my demo tonight so I'll be ready for my client in the morning. What do I do now? Is there any way I could get a copy from you? Marty thought it over. Well, I'll tell you what, he said. I'll put the compiler on my workstation just long enough for you to get it. Great. As soon as it's up, I'll transfer it to removable media so it won't be on my workstation either. Then I'll call you back to let you know I'm done, I said. And Marty?
Yeah.
I'll keep it a secret. I promise. Marty gave me the host name of his workstation so I could use FTP to transfer the file. To my surprise, he had enabled anonymous FTP access, so I didn't even need an account to get the files. Like taking candy from a baby. As far as I know, Marty never knew he was duped, and we'll find out only if he hears it here. Still high from the success of getting the compiler, I woke up to find that my phone was dead. I'd done something really stupid that put my freedom at risk. Not willing to risk making business calls associated with my new identity from a cloned cell phone, I got dressed and went to the closest payphone and called the phone company, Southern Bell, to find out why my phone wasn't working. After keeping me waiting for a long time, a supervisor came on the line and began asking a lot of questions. Then she told me, Michael Stanfield called us from Portland and said you're using his identity. That guy must be mistaken, I told her. I'll fax you a copy of my driver's license tomorrow to prove my identity. Suddenly I realized what had happened. The Raleigh Power Company, Carolina Power and Light, required a large deposit. If you had references from your former utility company, you could avoid paying it. So I'd called the power company that Michael Stanfill used in Oregon, Portland General Electric, and asked for a reference letter to be faxed. I told the lady on the other end of the line that I still wanted to keep my account in Oregon, but was buying property in Raleigh. When they sent the letter to me, they had apparently sent a courtesy copy to the real Stanfill as well. I felt like a total idiot. By trying to save a $400 deposit, I'd completely blown my cover. I had to move now. I had to get a new identity now. I had to get the hell out of my apartment now. I'd never even had a chance to attend one of those all-residence parties or manage to meet a cute girl. Finding a job had, of course, been one of my first priorities. I'd mailed out job resumes and cover letters as Michael Stanfill to more than 20 places, most of the potential employers in the area. Now, with my phone disconnected, none of these prospective employers would be able to reach me. Worse, it would be too risky to try the same places again under a different name. This put me at an extreme disadvantage. I'd signed a 6-month lease, so I told the round-faced lady in the rental office, I really like this place, but I've had a family medical emergency and have to leave. She said, if it's an emergency, the company will let you out of the lease, but they aren't going to refund you anything on this month's rent. I felt like saying, forget the refund, consider it a payoff, and if the feds show up asking questions, I was never here. The next day I took a new place across town at the Friendship Inn to live in while I searched for a new apartment. Even with my relatively few possessions, it took me several frustrating, nerve-wracking trips in my compact rental car to move everything to my new temporary digs. The pressure of having to find a new job and build a new identity was weighing on me. Little did I know that I had bigger things to worry about. I couldn't begin to imagine how the net was beginning to close around me. After settling in at the Friendship Inn using my Portland State University file, I chose another temporary name, Glenn Thomas Case. Since he, like Stanfill, was a living person and so riskier to borrow an identity from, I decided to go by G. Thomas Case to change things up a bit. 3 days later, the certified birth certificate I had requested arrived in my newly rented mailbox. I went to the DMV and walked out with my new North Carolina learner's permit, but I still had a lot of work ahead of me to secure the other.